This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Markets down, Bitcoin down, oil prices way down. Maybe this is a good time to pursue your lifelong dream of becoming a chef. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, November 20th. Thanks for joining us. We're going to dive into a couple slices of the big Wall Street sell-off that continued again today. Do expect the dramatic trombones a little later in the program. Yes, Apple was off another 5%, but oil in particular fell. Crude prices are down 30% since last month, and there are signs that the world economy and oil demand are slowing. On top of that, global supply is generous. Enjoy it if you're taking Thanksgiving road trips, but don't get comfortable. Longer term, the oil market could easily swing from too much to too little. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong explains that one.
Oil prices could rise in 2 weeks when the oil cartel OPEC and Russia meet to decide whether to cut supply and raise prices. But higher prices could backfire, warns Amy Myers Jaffe at the Council on Foreign Relations. She says the world economy looks fragile.
It is important for OPEC not to cut production too much and raise the price of oil to such an extent that it would damage the global economy and throw us into sort of a contagion recession.
There's also a long-term worry that beyond 2020, the emerging economies will surge back, but there won't be enough oil for them. Fatih Birol heads the International Energy Agency, which represents consuming countries. He told Bloomberg TV last week that the big oil companies are not investing in long-term supply.
The investment appetite is very, very low. We have to think a few years in front of us. Certainly, there is a strong demand growth, but where will the supply come from?
He predicts oil prices will jump to nearly $90 a barrel in 7 years. That's compared to about $60 today. But there's a competing view that long-term demand will not materialize. Economist David Knapp is with Energy Intelligence.
You talk about energy transition. For the developed world, it's really decarbonization. Decarbonization means less oil.
Climate policies present big unknowns for future oil prices. Will the move away from fossil fuels come? And if so, how quickly? I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
So you want to talk about market volatility? Let's talk about Bitcoin, right? What a difference a year makes. In December of last year, one Bitcoin was worth nearly $20,000. But all cryptocurrencies had a tough year, and Bitcoin value has dropped almost 80%. It was trading at more like $4,300 today. The why behind that drop? That was the assignment that Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson got today.
Part of that return to Earth was just inevitable.
There's a whole lot of things that came to bear, main one being that the prices were just way out of whack with reality.
Michael Casey is a senior advisor for the Digital Currency Initiative at MIT's Media Lab. He says lots of investors poured into cryptocurrencies looking to make a quick buck.
The money that sort of went in and is now coming out is largely speculative.
Plus, these cryptocurrencies are still new, tough to value. Gil Luria is director of research at D.A. Davidson.
there was an anticipation that institutional investors, the same investors that invest in stocks and bonds, would start investing in crypto assets, and that has not materialized.
And then there's regulation. David Yermak teaches a class on cryptocurrencies at NYU. He says in the last few years, an increasing number of companies have raised money through initial coin offerings, selling tokens the way other companies might sell stock.
The SEC has taken a fairly aggressive position that most of these under the law would qualify as securities and would have to file for certain regulatory oversight, pay certain fees, and basically meet a certain standard of disclosure on an ongoing basis.
That heightened regulatory pressure is also weighing on the value of cryptocurrencies. Yermak studies cryptocurrencies, but he doesn't invest in them.
Oh, no. It's incredibly risky.
Still, he thinks blockchain, the technology that underlies Bitcoin, shows lots of promise. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
So Bitcoin isn't the investment lottery, neither are oil or Apple, and yet here we are at holiday shopping time. And despite all those reports about consumers feeling flush and holiday spending likely to be huge, it's a good bet that a lot of that spending is going to happen on credit cards. And not to keep the bummer train rolling, but household debt is already at an all-time high. Marketplace's Sabree Benishore has more on what we're already paying for at home.
This holiday season, we will do what we always do and spend a lot of money that we may or may not have. James Boniker, economist with IHS, says it'll be a good year, but not a great year.
Not like last year in 2017, where consumers were anticipating tax cuts and spent pretty freely.
So last year, holiday sales were up 5.3%. This year, IHS thinks they'll be up 4.4%. Some of these sales will be put on credit cards. And it turns out that consumer debt right now is higher than it has ever been before. It grew by $500 billion over the last year. But right now, that's not a bad thing.
The more people that have jobs, that have rising incomes, the more access to credit they have.
The New York Fed keeps track of household debt, and it turns out credit card debt is not the biggest source of consumer debt in the economy, not even remotely close, about 6% of all household debt. Nor is it particularly responsible for the extra growth we've seen in consumer debt.
The big boost to all of this growth this past year has been from both student loans and auto loans.
Joelle Scally is a data strategist with the New York Fed. Now, the way you know how much debt is too much debt is when people can't pay it off. 4.7% of household debt is delinquent, up from 4.5% last quarter. A lot of that is from rising student loan delinquencies.
We did see a shift upwards in the credit card delinquency rates in the last few years, and it is something that we're a little bit concerned about.
But credit card, auto loan, and mortgage delinquencies are still nowhere near what they were during the recession. In New York, I'm Sabree Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, this is a spoiler. I'm pretty sure we're going to get that crazy sad music again. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Thanksgiving is just 2 short days away. I hope you are brining your turkey already. And much of America will be putting on their chef hats to whip up a feast that is pretty much a daily routine for this San Francisco chef. She's the next guest in our series, How to Be a Blank, and she's living her childhood dream.
I'm Dominique Rennes. I'm a chef, entrepreneur, artist, poet, human being. I have 3 restaurants in San Francisco, L'Atelier Crane, Bar Crane, and Petit Crane. I kind of do not like the word chef, you know, chef giving you a sense of hierarchy and power. To be a good cook and to be a good leader, it has to come from within and to understand others. So it's about someone that is willing to work hard, someone that has dedication, that has a passion. My mom was a great, great cook. She was not a chef, but she was a great cook. My dad was a terrible cook. He was in a political business. Cooking or eating out was something that we experienced a lot. At a very young age, I fell in love with the idea of like being in a restaurant and being surrounded with people around me. I don't think at the time I thought about becoming a chef. I have a bachelor's degree in economy. I've never went to a cooking school. What I thought when I came to San Francisco, if I wanted to get into the business of cooking, I needed to work with someone that will inspire me. It was about creating a path for myself and understanding where I wanted to go. When I interview people that want to work with us, I often disregard their resume because a piece of paper doesn't tell me really who they are. I'm looking for honesty, vulnerability. I'm looking for strength. I'm looking for weakness. I'm looking also for someone that wants to learn and is excited about learning. Not everybody has the skill, or not everybody understands how to cook. So they don't have to know how to cook, but I hope they can know how to eat.
Dominique Krenn is a chef based in San Francisco, California, and the host of the Krenn World Chef Series at her restaurant, Atelier Krenn. You can tell us about your dream jobs at marketplace.org. Now on to another kind of creative hustle, or creator hustle in this case. YouTubers, Instagram influencers, performers, and freelancers of all stripes are making careers on social platforms, and it involves a lot of ingenuity. Popular Instagrammers, for example, work really hard at creating a style for their own brand, down to the way all the photos look, with a consistent hue or tone. The whole goal is to make things look so much better than real life that you end up wanting to live their Instagram life and, of course, buy the brands they're hawking. Influencers create their individual filters by painstakingly tweaking the presets in the photo editing software Adobe Lightroom. And in typical creator hustle fashion, these influencers are now selling those presets. Taylor Lorenz wrote about it for The Atlantic. Taylor, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so help us understand, for those of us who might not be that techie, or those listeners who might not be that techie, what exactly is this new preset product?
Sure. So Lightroom presets have been around for a while. Lightroom is an Adobe photo editing tool that a lot of photographers use. But in the past year, they made an update to their mobile app, allowing people to create custom mobile filters. So kind of similar to like the filters that are already built in on Instagram. And influencers use them to create a really curated aesthetic on their feed. If you are, say, a lifestyle influencer and you live by the water and you have a very beachy aesthetic, maybe you have a preset that makes all of your, you know, photos look very bright and airy and sort of like sun-kissed. If you're maybe more moody and you're an influencer in the Pacific Northwest, you might have that kind of moody, dark look. It's just a really kind of clean way to brand yourself and make sure that all of your photos have similar look and vibe and they all kind of go with each other.
So the design part makes total sense. The most Instagram part of it is, when does it cross over into a product? At what point are people saying, I'm so influenced by your feed that I want my Instagram feed to look just like yours?
Well, as you know, if you look at a lot of top influencers' Instagram feeds, they look just really beautiful. And so a lot of followers see that and they want it for their own feeds, especially if they're aspiring influencers themselves. Or a few I spoke to said that the number one question that they got from their fans on Instagram was like, how do you make your photos look like that? So selling them, you know, a $25 preset is a really good way to monetize, because it's like how you want to emulate somebody you look up to or someone you admire. You know, it's almost kind of like copying them in a way, but it's like a tribute.
How much are people willing to spend on these presets? Is it a real revenue stream?
Yes. I mean, one good thing for influencers is that it is sort of this passive income. Once you make a set of presets, you really don't have to update them that often. You can put them on a third-party site. They'll handle all the back end and customer service. So you can just kind of be making money, thousands of dollars a month in some cases. You know, a lot of these influencers rely on more sort of longer-term sponsored content deals, and those can take a longer time to negotiate, and the payout might be bigger, but it can be few and far between. So selling things like presets or merch is a good way to kind of like provide some sort of daily money coming in.
Do we have a sense of what Adobe might think about influencers reselling their product?
I spoke to the product manager on Lightroom and they were surprised. I think they didn't even realize how captivated the Instagram influencer world had become with the product. But knowing that that is a big subset, they're definitely doing more to cater to that group.
It feels like we could expect either a crackdown or a whole new series of products from Adobe if they're smart.
Yeah, definitely not a crackdown. They love that influencers are creating this. They just want as many people as possible to use the app. So if all of these people with 5 million followers on Instagram are telling their followers to download the app and download their presets, that's a good thing for Adobe.
Taylor Lorenz covers the influencer beat for The Atlantic. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up.
You know, fighting is about truth. It's one place in the world you can't make believe.
The beauty and tragedy of the fight. But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, there it is. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 551 points, 2.2% to close at 24,465. The NASDAQ shed 119 points, 1.7%, better than yesterday, to end at 6908. And the S&P 500 gave back 48 points, 1.8% to finish at 2641. The Wall Street Journal reports that Walgreens Boots Alliance and health insurer Humana are discussing taking equity stakes in one another. Walgreens shed 2.6%. Humana took off 1%. Energy companies, of course, dropped in line with sharply falling oil prices. Bond prices fell slightly. The yield on the 10-year T-note remains at 3.06%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace is able to do what we do every day thanks to funding from public radio stations, foundations, corporate underwriters, and listeners like you. Thank you to all the Marketplace investors who've contributed over the past year for helping keep public service journalism strong. We appreciate your support.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. More than 114,000 New York City public school students were homeless at some point in the last school year, according to figures from New York State. That's around 1 in 10 of that city's public school kids. And New York isn't the only state. The number of homeless public school students has been rising across the country, according to state and national data. Julia Simon went to the Bronx, the New York City borough with the most homeless students, to see how it's affecting these kids and their schools.
10-year-old Taja Ford is a fourth grader in the Bronx, a wearer of tiny unicorn earrings, a lover of math.
Because I like working with numbers.
And because of domestic violence, a resident of homeless shelters. She's been living in them since June, along with her mother and siblings.
When I got there, it was crazy. I don't know. It was really different. I'd never been in that place before. And we all had to share a room, and it was, like, difficult, really difficult.
Each morning, the family wakes at 5:30.
There's only one bathroom, so, like...
Then she heads out into the city, from her shelter in the North Bronx to her school in Harlem.
Up those hills, those stairs, and catch a train. This train station is really cold.
Taja's commute's 45 minutes, but many students who live in shelters travel more than 2 hours each way to get to school. That's according to Danielle Keene, the principal of an elementary and middle school in the South Bronx.
And then we're expecting them to go home, do their homework, deal with whatever else they're dealing with, then to get back on the bus at 5, 6 o'clock in the morning to get here and be perky and ready to go. And it's not happening.
Lots of things aren't happening for these students. In the corner of Keene's office, near the door, a small black duffel bag lies on the floor.
A shelter child that dropped their clothes off and said, "Can you wash them?" And they leave it here, and we go and wash it across the street.
Keene's school has more than 700 kids, from preschool through eighth grade. More than 150 don't have permanent housing. They're living in shelters, cars, doubled up with family or friends. She says many of these kids have trouble showing up for class every day.
We have some children that have missed 84 days of school in 1 year.
Keene's school has a new morning program for middle schoolers in temporary housing that's increased attendance by almost 50%, helping kids start their mornings in a smaller, less stressful class setting. The New York City Department of Education plans to spend up to $28 million on special programs and personnel to help homeless students this school year. Carol Graham is a social worker who works with homeless kids at Keene School. She says they require the faculty to deal with a lot more than just education.
So we're doing dual purposes here, meeting their social and emotional needs, as well as educating them as well.
As for 10-year-old Taja, she's about to start at a new school, much closer to the shelter where her family's staying. Taja's happy she won't have to wake up so early, sad to leave her friends at her old school, and hoping that soon her family finds a permanent place to live. In the Bronx, I'm Julia Simon for Marketplace.
A new docuseries premiered on Netflix this fall. It explores different kinds of fighting around the world, like Muay Thai in Thailand and Krav Maga in Israel. These styles developed because of the experiences and cultures of the people in those countries, and also because of their economies.
The world over, cultures have been shaped through combat. Each culture unique in their approach to scratch out their survival. But this isn't a show about fighting. This is a show about people who fight.
The show is called Fight World. Frank Grillo, its creator and host, is an actor best known for his roles in The Purge, The Gray, and for playing Crossbones in the Marvel Universe. He also describes himself as a lifelong fight enthusiast. Frank, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So you are clearly delighted throughout this series so many times to be interacting with these trainers and these boxers that you clearly admire. What is it that you like so much about fighting?
I think most of all, it is the camaraderie, the brother and sisterhood of fighting. It kind of transcends race and religion and economic background. And, you know, fighting is about truth. There's one place in the world you can't make believe is in a ring or in a cage or on a mat. And so, you know, it's an honest, authentic pursuit of something that's primordial, and we all have it in us.
Every day we go and we fight, whatever you do, in a business, in a court of law, in a hospital, you're fighting, you are going through challenges.
I mean, in this series, it seems very clear that the economics of the places that you visited have really shaped the fight cultures there, right? Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Any true fight culture, whether it's Julio Cesar Chavez, one of the greatest boxers out of Mexico of all time, or one of the warriors in Africa, or Buk Hao, who's the greatest Muay Thai fighter in Thailand, they all came from the same thing, which was extreme levels of poverty. And they were fighting not for fame at the time. They're literally fighting for their lives and for the lives of their families.
It's interesting because it feels like a little bit of a mixed message, right? On the one hand, you're saying that it's beauty and camaraderie. On the other hand, there's a bit of a message that fighting can come from desperation.
And that's kind of like the genesis of the idea of the show is to kind of demystify what people think about fighters. Because when you really get to know fighters, so many of them are spiritual or they're so humble. And they fight for a living, and so they don't walk around the streets looking for fights. They're probably the least apt to get into a fight. You know, that's what I wanted to show an audience, is how beautiful the fight cultures around the world really are.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess the sort of obvious pushback question here, and like, Frank, I'm a mom.
Right.
I mean, it's really violent.
It is, and I'm a dad, and I have three sons. My oldest son, who's 21, is about to fight in a smoker fight, and he's in college, and I'm looking at him, and he's really good, and he's a good athlete, and I'm looking at him, and I'm saying, this is after this, you're done. Like, you don't need to do this. And that's what I tell people. If there's not some crazy calling you have in your body that makes you want to be a professional fighter, then don't go near it. It hurts a lot to get hit.
Boxing, of course, used to be a huge cultural influence in America. It is on the decline a bit as a mainstream sport. HBO actually just dropped it last month. Is this series with boxing on the decline, with this whole conversation about football and violent sports, is there a possibility that it's a love letter but also a goodbye?
No, I don't think boxing's going anywhere. I think the I think the popularity of the UFC is just kind of, you know, it's kind of taken a little bit of the gloss off of boxing. And, you know, HBO has been known for many, many years to be kind of like the go-to place for the best fighters in the world. But, you know, it all ebbs and flows. It goes through cycles. Mm.
All right, this is a side note, but I want to ask you before I let you go. You have been a member of the Marvel family, which, of course, just lost Stan Lee.
I know.
And I was wondering what you guys are all feeling about that.
You know, real sadness. And listen, I'm a secondary, maybe a tertiary character in that world, but I'm in that world. And I've spent a lot of time on those sets. And Stan was always there. He knew everyone's name. You can't. I've been all over the world. And what people recognize most of all are the Marvel characters. And that's Mr. Stan Lee.
Frank Grillo is creator and host of Fight World. Thanks so much for the time, Frank.
Thank you so much.
This final note before we go, the holiday week is a big one for binge watching and on-demand rentals, but there's a new trend in streaming services that can save you money if you're willing to watch movies with ads. YouTube, in the last week or so, added full-length movies with commercials. Roku has the same thing. Walmart streams free ad-supported movies on the Vudu service. And on Friday, after Thanksgiving, YouTube will actually stream an ad-supported movie that is itself an ad. You can stream the Lego movie for free all day long. It is a ploy to promote the sequel, but your kids are going to love it. All right, we got to go. The Dow down 551 points today. The NASDAQ shed 119 points. S&P 500 gave back 48 points. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Satara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. And I'm Molly Wood. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.